Hello, and welcome to Mangasplaining, the show where we recommend great manga to folks who haven't read much manga before. Hosted by Deb Aoki, David Brothers, Christopher Butcher, and Chip Zdarsky. Follow along with our show notes and reading lists at mangasplaining.com. This week's my pick, and it's a little different, I guess. It's called Blood on the Tracks by Shuzo Oshimi. It's published by Kodansha. It's translated by Daniel Komen. Production by Risa Cho and Larina Mappa. And the U.S. editor is Daniel Joseph. I guess it's a suspense story. In some ways, you could think of it as a horror story, psychological drama, something like that. I'm going to ask you what you thought it was, but basically, it's a story about a middle school boy and his overprotective mother and the stuff that happens that we can't quite get into too much. But anyway, you know this is Mangasplaining, and you know this is spoilerific. So I hope you've read volumes 1 and 2 because we're going to spoil away. Okay? All right. Now, first thing up, the best way to start is to read the description from Kodansha, which is, from the creator who brought you notable works such as The Flowers of Evil, Happiness, and Inside Mari, comes a new suspense drama centering on the theme of a toxic parent. Dive into this latest thriller by the master storyteller Shuzo Oshimi as he delivers his most unsettling work yet. The tale of a seemingly normal family suddenly swallowed up by the creeping horror of everyday life. Seiichi's mother loves him very much, and his days pass by with placid regularity. School, friends, even the attention of an attractive classmate, Fuki Ishii. Until one terrible summer day, all that changes. So, I guess I'm going to ask, you know, Shuzo Oshimi is kind of interesting and notable that he has several works of his available in English. Not just Blood on the Tracks, but there's also Drifting Net Cafe, Flowers of Evil, Happiness, Inside Mari, Shino Can't Say Your Name. There's a whole lot. I wanted to start with David and Chris. Have you read any of Shuzo Oshimi's other works?
No.
Really?
No. I can get into it, but no.
I'm so surprised that I had to think about my answer for a second. Like, so I read several volumes of Flowers of Evil and a few chapters of Inside Mari on Crunchyroll manga. And sort of like this, like they're all just like unsettling through and through.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't even tell you really what Flowers of Evil was about, except just like a boy being routinely debased and humiliated, you know?
Yep.
And it's a hard genre for me, or not a hard genre, rather, Oshimi's work is kind of tough for me because I'm not super into the line work. I think some of the shots that Oshimi calls are really interesting, like the perspective and observation is fascinating, but like the actual drawing, I'm not super into.
Mm.
Like it's good, but not quite my bag. So I never really dug super deep into his work, but I always kind of saw it from afar and was like, oh, like that's the creepy guy. Like he occupies this lane of creepy, sort of like sexual thrillers, psychosexual thrillers, I guess they called them in the 90s.
That sounds about right. Okay.
Yeah. But so Chris, how did you never read Flowers of Evil? I feel like it would have been up your alley back in the day.
I'm a big fan of Inio Sano. And I really like Inio Sano's work. And I read Girl on the Shore. And Girl on the Shore is a tough book to read. Girl on the Shore is a very tough book to read. But a boy just getting debased. And so when Flowers of Evil came out, it was like, for fans of Girl on the Shore. And I was like, nah. Like, Girl on the Shore is a good book. Like, I think it's actually like a really good, smart book that deals with really difficult things.
Yeah.
And also, I don't want to go back to that well unless someone is like, this is a 10 out of 10. And no one was saying.
Unless somebody goes, you're now on a manga podcast and you have to read it.
Yeah, sorry. Maybe that's Chip's pick this week so we can all go read Flowers of Evil. No, it takes a lot for me to willfully pick up a book that I know is going to bum me out.
Mm.
I used to read a lot of stuff that was more challenging that way when I was younger, and as I get older, it's just, I was actually kind of dreading reading this one too.
Really?
Because I knew his reputation and I knew kind of what the book was about. Because if you read, you know, solicits or things like that, like the solicitation text, you get to like the third or fourth volume, and it's like, oh, this is about somebody's overbearing mother, and you know, this issue, this whatever, and you're just like, oh man, this could go so wrong so many ways. And then I read the first two volumes for today's podcast, and it did. So yeah, it's
I love that Girl on the Shore was your example, because actually I was just looking at that earlier today on my shelf, and I read the book on the bus to work one morning, and the whole time I was like, I'm sitting like in the back corner, like the creepiest possible place to sit and read a manga like that. Yep. And it was just a mess. Like, I can never read something like that in public again.
No, you probably probably shouldn't.
Was it disturbing or sad, or what was it made?
It was way more open about what middle schoolers get up to sexually than I was expecting.
Or that most people are comfortable with.
Yeah. Wow. And not even in like a titillating, like, this is, you know, for the creeps kind of way. It's like, oh no, we're going to use this to, like, you know, exercise some bad feelings.
First of all, like, this one's for the creeps.
Yeah.
Oh no, there's a lot of books out there that are for the creeps, and Girl on the Shore is not one of those books.
No, I know. Somebody sent me a link to the manga the other day where they were like, oh, I just read this manga. It reminds me of Sex Criminals. It's about like a boy who stops time, and there's all sorts of sexy escapades. And I looked at like one chapter of it, and it's horrible. I don't even want to talk about it. I'm like, I almost like blocked my friend.
Yep.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's my, I guess, our foundation coming into Oshimi.
Yeah, it was just like, I heard it was like along those lines, but not as accomplished. And I'm like, well, I'm good. Like, I'm sure it's good. People love it, but it's not, I'm not going to pick up a book that I know is going to bum me out unless someone is like, you know, podcasting about it.
Yeah. I love that we both got psyched out.
I'll be really blunt with you guys. I stopped reading Flowers of Evil halfway through because it made me sound comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I've generally avoided most of his work. Mm-hmm. Because it's, you know, this general trope of like the pubescent boy and a terrible girl get together. And it's like, what? But for some reason or another, and I don't know exactly why, I picked up Blood on the Tracks. And the next thing I knew, I was just completely engrossed in it. I mean, it was horrifying in a lot of ways. It was difficult to read in some ways, but I thought the pacing was really interesting. Yeah. And the way that the horror unfolds is really interesting, which is why I recommended it, because I thought Chip and he might find, I guess, the storytelling interesting. So I guess I'll push it over to Chip now. What did you think of this book?
I mean, you were right. Like, I've never read anything like this in terms of storytelling and pacing. Like, the fact that there were so many like double page spreads just of like a smiling, beautiful mother. Or what was the one, just the kid going, it was just like mommy said. After, I want to say 10, 11 pages of build-up after the officer asks if that happened the way she said it did. Like, it's just so, like, so much space is used just for, like, a build-up of, like, of just an answering a question.
Mm-hmm.
I found it super, super fascinating. Like David, I mean, probably not as much as David, but I definitely bounced off the line work.
Oh,
only,
really?
only when the artist attempted to do black shadows. Like, I thought they did that very poorly, but in the lighter scenes with the, kind of the cross hatching, it really kind of works with what they're trying to do, and it becomes less obvious that they maybe don't necessarily know a lot about rendering with those. Mm. With those pages, which the majority of this is that. Like, it'd be weird. Like, every once in a while, I would just switch over for a few pages to just like kind of heavy black shadows, but like in a very kind of high school way. Like, oh, maybe this is how you do that. But yeah, I mean, besides the art quibbles, like, yeah, I was really fascinated by this book, and there was definitely. I'm glad you assigned two volumes. Because at the end of volume one, I was like, well, I got to go to volume two. And frankly, at the end of volume two, I really wanted to go to volume three.
Wow.
And the only reason I didn't is because I got no time for this.
Fair enough.
But like, you know, I mean, you know, you said at the beginning of the show, you know, there are spoilers here. And this is probably the one title where I would highly recommend people stop listening right now if you want to read the book. And then come back to the podcast, because from here on out, like, we're going to talk about what happens in volume two, which is mommy is a creep.
Mommy is disturbed.
Whoa, the whole that whole scene at the end of like the letter, like it's so weird because everything is very slow, a lot of build up, and you know there were like obviously key moments like the cousin being pushed off the cliff. Everything else was just kind of like waiting for things to kind of unravel, and then that scene was just like it was like bang, bang, bang. It was like the girl's in his room, mom comes home, the girl's out of the room, there's a letter. Mom forces him to like look at it with her. Like you just see everything, just like all the dominoes falling in that scene. And then when she's just like manically, just like let's destroy this together. Like that's when you know it's like, you know, pushing the kid off the cliff. Like who hasn't wanted to do that? But
yeah,
wow. But that scene with the son, like we must tear this up together, destroy it together. You're just like, oh. I know what's coming next, and I don't want to see it, but I'm turning the page anyways. This is getting into some Game of Thrones shit. Yeah, it was really, really creepy, and I definitely wanted to find out what happens next, especially since, you know, the cousin didn't die, and now we've got this whole thing happening.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and then the flashbacks of the cat, like, there's obviously a lot of backstory there, and I don't know. I mean, Deb, you've probably read beyond.
I've only read up to volume four because that's all I could take for now.
Really? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm super curious as to the rest of his childhood and her past and everything that might have contributed to this horrific scenario.
Yeah, I got the feeling there's stuff like that he's probably going to figure out was bad in the past that already happened, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, she killed the cat. Like, we all know killed the cat, right?
Well, look, the jury's out.
I mean, she could have made him kill the cat.
Oh, yeah, there you go. I didn't think of that one.
So, David, given that what you came in with some baggage about Shujo Oshimi, did this change your mind about him a little bit, or?
I know, this was like full confirmation. This was sort of exactly what I expected. But well executed. I think, like, despite, you know, not really being into the line work, like, he knows what creepy is. And, you know, the last 20 pages of the book more than prove that.
Yeah.
But also, there's something in this book, storytelling-wise, about hands and touching that, like, really struck me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's the moment when the son is like, you know, yeah, it's just like mommy said. And it's after she removes her hand from his back. And, like, he suddenly feels the distance between them or something. Was the feeling I got from how it was drawn. I'm trying to flip through.
Yeah, yeah.
Find it now. There's always like a close-up of her hugging his back. Like there are so many little things that add up to this creepy feeling. Her sister always having that kind of like wide smile in every panel she's in until her son gets pushed off a cliff. Like it's a lot.
Yeah.
The rendering that Chip mentioned, it made it feel even more paranoid to me, to where almost every page was like a little bit anxiety inducing because like it feels like a horror movie or like a thriller, like an A24, you know, something.
Yeah.
Even though sometimes the rendering really does not look good, like on page 68 is there's just volume one. It's when his cousin says, you know, like, hey, your family's kind of overprotective. And the kid's like, what does that mean? Like, it just doesn't work for me on this page, but like the actual angles and the faces kind of do. Like, you see, like, oh, he's on the cusp of a realization.
Yeah.
And the eye motif also shows up on here. There's a lot of slow zooms on eyes. I think volume two had one at the very end where it was like two eyes stacked on each other that then turned into a mouth. One of the creepiest things I've seen in ages.
The double page spreads. So, sorry, let's go back to what you were saying. Yeah, I agree 100%. This is an incredibly successful book. Mm-hmm. It's successful at making you feel just tense and creeped out and like a little upset about how it's all going down. I honestly think he's definitely a better mangaka, which it means, you know, writing, drawing, all that kind of stuff, than I maybe gave him credit for, in addition to all the creepy stuff that people would not stop talking about Flowers of Evil when it was popular, when it was coming out. It was a shocking, shocking manga to get an anime that people also hated, but still couldn't stop watching.
Was that one of the early CG animes too?
Yeah, it was like,
Yeah.
Cel-shaded or something. It was some of it was from live action too.
It was rotoscoped. That was it. Because it also looked very creepy.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, yeah. It was strange.
That's a choice.
No offense intended, but I remember looking at it going, this looks just as bad as the manga, but in a totally different way. Because I didn't think that the manga was very well drawn. But even now, I think that a lot of the problems you guys are pointing out, it's not an artistic quibble. He really can't draw certain things at all.
Mm-hmm.
But he can draw certain things so well. The double page spreads, I want to go back to, when he does a double page spread of someone's face or the mother smiling at him, warmly, but in a way that just keeps getting creepier and creepier as the book goes on. Mm-hmm. Incredible. So good. Such a thoughtful use of pacing to ratchet up that tension like you would in a horror movie. And you kind of expect there to be a jump scare at the end of some of these things. Yeah. You expect there to be something some huge thing that happens, but it's not. It actually just goes gross. It gets creepy instead of scary, which is scary in a different...
I think other than the cat, is she the only one that gets one of those double page spreads?
I mean, he does as well.
Close to his.
He does? Yeah. Okay.
He does when he finally answers the officer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah. Deb, you've asked us a lot of questions about what we think about it, but I just noticed you haven't maybe volunteered your own thoughts on the first two volumes of Blood on the Tracks yet, other than to say it was a lot. What are
you Well, like I said, I generally am not a fan of, like you, Chris, and like you, David, I'm not a great fan of books that make you feel crappy about what's going on, you know? I mean, I couldn't even do it. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, right? Where they just can't get to where they need to go. It's just frustrating.
Yeah.
This is different in that you're watching things fall apart, but in slow motion. You're watching things through his eyes as a young boy who, formerly believed that his mother was, loving and sweet and kind, and seeing that illusion being just torn apart bit by bit, and he's struggling to understand that. He's also struggling to understand the part that nobody else, no other adult can see this.
Yeah.
That his father seems oblivious, his cousins seem oblivious. There's this moment after she pushes off Shigeru and then she's mumbling to herself. That's very disturbing.
Yeah, yeah.
And possibly not within a middle school kid's ability to understand.
No, not at all.
So there's this tension with Shuzo Shimi's work where he seems to deal with boys who are on the cusp of puberty, on that bridge, on that threshold between being a boy and being a man, and that uncomfortable feeling of, I have puberty, I have hormones racing through me, I'm no longer innocent, but I'm no longer adult enough to understand what's happening. So I always sometimes wonder, do you react to this kind of work differently if you're a male reading it? Because a lot of the female characters in his books are just evil.
Yeah.
Finally, a book that says what we're all thinking.
But again, it's it was super compelling, and I thought it was just really interesting how the story unfolded. Mm-hmm. It makes you feel, it doesn't go for the easy scare, right? Mm.
No.
It doesn't go for the predictable scare. It's like, whoa, I didn't see that push off the cliff thing coming.
Yeah.
I didn't
Volume one is almost, up until the push off the cliff happens, it's creepy, but it's not wrong necessarily.
Yeah.
There's a dread feeling infesting everything, but she's not overtly bad yet. It's just, the benefit of age and wisdom hopefully being oh no, these are red flags popping all over the place.
Yeah, it kind of mirrors the kids because the reader's kind of am I projecting here? Is this as bad as it seems? Which is a talented thing to put off.
I was thinking maybe it's a Munchausen syndrome thing. I was trying to sort of figure out where it was going with the abuse angle, because the abuse was obvious, but the nature of the abuse was not. And I think most people at this point grew up with the idea of stranger danger. And so my mom was a social worker in the early 90s when I was a kid. So I had the stranger danger AP class, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because, she would go out and see all the real things that people would do to each other and their kids.
Dang.
And so books like this, I can read them kind of from a distance, but they still feel really visceral. Because like this is like exactly what I was warned against when I was a kid. Not literally exactly, but you know what I mean. Like,
yeah.
Protect yourself. Like, if anything weird feelings happen, you know, find an adult, someone you can trust. And this book is just sort of about this kid being in over his head, like unable to cope with any of it. And judging by what I know of Oshimi's work, it's not going to get better for at least like 5 or 6 volumes.
How many volumes is this total?
There's 11 so far.
11?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Volume 7 comes out on October 19th in English, but okay. Volume 11 is out in Japan. If you go to the manga splaining Excel sheet, on I have like a little picture there that I kind of want you to take a look at.
That's for hosts only, not for listeners.
We may insert it into the show notes.
But it shows Volume 7, which is this picture of this close-up of them, of the mother and son. And then Volume 8 is a black and white picture of a schoolgirl. And then Volume 9, 10, 11 is very different looking.
Yeah, I guess they're in confrontation with each other almost.
Like it turns blood red and more of like a collage type of thing. So it's interesting because all the covers, if you look at them in from Volume 1 to Volume 7, are just these normal, everyday, loving photos of a normal childhood, right? From the baby to going to your first time going to school. And then you see him grow up. And then there's that turning point after Volume 7.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, these covers are gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love, like, his work generally has good design wrapped around it, I think. Like, Flowers of Evil was so simple. The covers were just like a figure and like a word balloon or something like that. With the title or something,
but yeah, it changed midway too. To watercolors and stuff like that. Like it's very purposeful.
Yeah, that attention to detail is so cool.
The covers and the handling of the text on the English versions, like Volume 1 and 2, are not very good, especially compared to what I'm seeing here with the Japanese editions.
Yeah, that's a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, they kind of need a bit of a redesign for English instead of just straight translating the text.
Mm-hmm.
I think licensing issues, like there are licensing issues where you've got to kind of do the exact cover and try and keep it as tight as possible. But looking at the Japanese cover, I think that they tried very hard to try and keep it as close as possible, and I think they could have gone a different direction that maybe would have been more successful because these covers are designed for vertical text and. I mean, obviously, we don't really read that way in North America. So I think that's a big part of it. I think the font is an interesting choice compared to the Japanese edition. But I don't know. I've been in meetings. I've sat in meetings, as has David, about how to address these exact issues. And man, you just try your best. But like, yeah, for sure. But also, you look at his artwork. The photograph on the Volume 7 cover that's there of the mom and son versus the photograph of Volume 1, he's just gotten better as an artist. Like, he is... We're watching him improve, I think, not quite in real time. I think it's amazing. You know, it's amazing to see where he's at as an artist just on these covers later on and how he's changed and how he's improved. But
well, also, there's clearly a plan where you start off with like the gentle photos and then you start to get a bit more distorted and adding the red and stuff. Unfortunately, that doesn't help you sell Volume 1. Like when I look at this, I'm just like, is this like a historical drama, maybe, about these characters?
You went in completely blind, huh?
Completely blind. So I'm just like, I don't know what this is. And then next thing you know, it's a psychosexual mother-son thriller horror with murder.
I will say, it's not in Andrew's wheelhouse, but I went to pick up Volume 1 at the store. And he's like, what's that? And I'm like, Blood on the Track. He's like, oh, is it new? And I'm like, no, it's been out for 3.5-4 years now. It's like, this is Volume 1, but it's like Volume 7 is just about to come out. He's like, I have never seen that book. And it's been in a store. I think it's just kind of a forgettable presentation. I don't know that it necessarily serves the work. Also, I like to shove in as much Andrew content as possible because he's great.
But don't you think that works to create like this beautiful box that has a surprise in it?
Yeah, but you got to get someone to open the box.
That's true.
That's the beauty of book design, right?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't love it. I don't love the cover and the what color page.
Yeah, I was going to say the color pages.
In volume one, I think with the like sort of fisheye forced perspective, yeah, it's kind of amateurish, but I actually like it as like showing kind of old timey memory. Chip, what do you think?
Kind of going through it again. It's poor painting. And like, there's not really a lot of color decisions happening here. So what's the point? Once again, I'm struggling with what the point is.
Hey, I remember the color page in volume two happening at a weird time. Like as I was reading, I was like, oh.
Yeah, that was interesting.
That but now, of course, I can't find it flipping through.
Oh, there was a color page in the middle?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
When the would-be girlfriend comes to the door, it's in color. And that was, yeah, surprising.
Page 130. 129, sorry.
Yeah.
And it's just a couple of pages.
Yeah.
It actually looks like colored line art versus being a painting.
Yeah, it's very, very different than what you would expect because it is, yeah, it's just graphically colored.
Yeah. Though this page does bring another thing to mind about the presentation of the book. Mm. How would you three describe the sound effects? Page 130, there's the zig, zig, zig sound and a sure, sure, sure. What is that supposed to represent?
I have no idea. When I was reading, I was just like, what's going on? Most of the sound effects, I'm like, what is this?
Yeah.
I kind of tended to ignore them after a while. Page I just think that they're like a weird ambience thing.
Page 130 of volume two.
Mm. Oh, volume two. Sorry, I've got the wrong one open. Sorry yeah. about that.
So I suspect the one of them is like a cicada noise because yeah. that's just yeah. ever present.
Yeah. In summertime, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the other, I'm not sure. It's like shay, 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 and it's sure, sure, sure in English. Maybe like wind blowing or something like that, but it's on almost every page. Like it's so frequent. Yeah. Well, not every page, but you know, it's in every chapter, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's just the sound of cicadas.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the long tree might be the door opening? Or the
Z, no, zig, zig, zig.
Japanese, that would be like G,
yeah.
like a creaky door opening. But the, yeah. yeah, the next page, like the zig, 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 and the sh- yeah, I think it's got to be
kind cicadas. Of. Took me out a little bit, and I think that's not anything the fault of the translation team. It's just a language barrier thing, is that I don't have that sound in my, you know, database.
Yeah.
Right,
you know,
right,
like,
right.
If I see a kaboom, like it's a fake noise, but like I know what that sounds like in my head because of, you know, years of exposure. But this was, it's very rare that I hit things like that in manga nowadays, but this one kind of got me a little bit.
Yeah, that's interesting because like that's some cultural differences, right? Like when there's a school scene and you see cherry blossom, you know, petals in the wind, to them, that's the same as autumn leaves in America because school starts in the fall. For them, school starts in March, right? So there's that some cultural signifiers and like the cicada sound, that's every summer.
Yeah.
I've never heard a cicada since I've been in the Bay Area, ever. I barely hear crickets. Trip. I mean,
yeah, I haven't heard of crickets since I left Georgia. Yeah.
So.
But there are other little touches, like the word balloons that had like fake text, like when after she pushes the boy off the cliff and she's kind of mumbling to herself, the first couple balloons are squiggles. Mm-hmm. And there's one with a TV that also has squiggles. That's an effect that I like a lot. I think it's like such a good use of comics as a form to say like, this is unintelligible and it doesn't matter what it is, but you need to know something is here, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, David, now that you mentioned it, I had actually started blocking out the sound effects because I remember when that, like the mean one, like the mean or whatever. Or the,
yeah, what they, also a cicada sound, I believe.
Mm-hmm. But like, they're everywhere in these first two volumes and it didn't register like what they were. Like when she's walking up the stairs here on page 136 and it's like, it's like, okay, that makes sense. Or a door opens, ka-chick, like that makes sense. But like, these like... I could have used some translator notes. I'm going to be honest here. I don't understand what these like random, like it's not even the sound of silence, like that we've learned about here on Manga Explaining. Maybe we'll open this up on Twitter or something and ask if anyone knows what the hell is supposed to be going on with these sound effects. But yeah, I did find it distracting and then I blocked it out. But now that you've mentioned it, I can't stop seeing them again.
I would like to see this adapted to... I mean, I wouldn't like to see it, but if it were adapted, it would have a very oppressive, like, audio atmosphere with all the noise from outside from the cicadas. And I think they're building that kind of atmosphere in the book. just like having that always present. But because, you know, like I don't speak Japanese very well, it wasn't quite my bag.
I was going to ask, are there aspects of this story that are uniquely Japanese that this type of story would not unfold this way if it was an American mother and son?
The girlfriend showing up at the house with the love note, I feel like it's a very Japanese thing, or at least Japanese like romance story trope. The love confession is not something we really do in the same way in the U.S. Maybe in Canada, I don't know.
No.
In Canada, we travel kilometers across the snow in order to deliver our first love letter. The rite of passage.
Yeah. But I mean, he's a latchkey kid. You know, his dad is often working. His dad is in like four panels of the book, now that I'm thinking about it. He's barely present. It all felt very familiar to me. Like, this is just young teen life. Or maybe even preteen, I forget.
He's 13. He's 13.
13, yeah. You know, he gets pantsed at one point. He has like a crush in the class that he's awkward talking to.
Yeah.
The swimsuits are a very not American thing.
Yeah, that's true. I was so happy when he like made fun of her, but she liked him too. And that was like actually cute. Like I was really happy for him for a moment. That made it worse. That made it so much worse because I was like, I know where this is going. The writing is just top notch. I got to say, it's not comfortable it's definitely not gonna be for everybody. Like, whoa. Like if you are, there's a number of people on social media who listen to every podcast and try to download every book. And it's like, please don't. Like if this is sounding like something that you don't want to read, like don't read it.
Yeah, and it's not even explicit yet.
No.
I mean, the most explicit thing happens, I think in volume two, you see a broken leg and then there's the kiss at the end, which is extremely like gross, but not nude, I guess. You know?
Yeah.
It's safe for work, I guess is what I'm trying to say, in the most generous definition of the phrase.
Please don't read this book at work. No. I'm begging you, manga explaining listeners. Don't listen to David Brothers.
But yeah, the writing's super great. And I think that's what makes it so creepy. I mean, obviously that's what makes it so creepy, but you can believe in the characters. Like he's a very normal boy. You know, when he says like, don't talk about my mom that way. Like it's such like a normal reaction. Mm. And then for his mom to be, you know, corrupted or whatever, it just makes it even more of a tragedy, I think.
Yeah.
I'm just looking through some pages again. And like at the end, after, you know, he looks at the letter, like she's all smiles too. That's the really creepy part. She's like super smiley.
Yeah.
Even with the girl there in the room and stuff. And then she hands him the letter, she's all smiles. And then, you know, you see this, the teardrop. And then the next page is her just like crying. Like, oh, this is where things just turn.
That scene stressed me out.
When she says like, let's get rid of the letter, all of a sudden his mouth opens. And then his mouth is just wide open for like page after page after page. Mm-hmm. Until he finally lets out like, just like, like just that feeling of just like, I scream, but I have no voice. Like, it's just, it's a terrifying thing. I found this to be a lot scarier than Censor, the Junji Ito book. Like, I've only read a couple of Junji Ito books, but you kind of get the rhythm of it, and then it kind of stops being scary once in a while. Like, oh, what a creepy panel. Yeah. What a creepy drawing, and clearly a master of what he does. But this I found to be a lot more horrific. With more kind of interesting pacing to actually like make it feel more horrific.
Yeah. The like decompression in comics was a big buzzword, I guess, 10 years ago now. I don't know if people care anymore. But this is like an example of what makes decompression good. Because like it takes her an entire page to open the letter and then an entire other page for her to read the letter, and then like her gaze kind of softens as she reads, and then she convinces him to read it, and then that's like a whole other page, and there's a full page for the letter. Like there's so much tension building here.
Yeah.
And I didn't see the crying coming. Like it's tension, and then there's also like you honestly don't know where it's going to go except that it's going to be bad.
that's what makes it worse, right?
Yeah, like it's inevitable.
You know it's going to be worse, but you don't know how it's going to be worse.
Yeah. And I apologize for the phrasing, but I feel like the son gets jokerized at the end when he smiles just like she does after they kiss.
Yes. Jokerized is the correct way to put it, I think.
Yikes. Like, he just collapses. This was a really effective book, like Chris was saying.
Also, I know, I just know it's a weird thing because I'm looking at those last few pages too. It's like when they tear it up and they're like, they're looking at each other and then the kiss happens.
Mm-hmm.
The two pieces of the letter that are still floating around say any and first. Wow. And just the idea that that's like his first kiss. Mm. It's just like just a whole other level of creepy.
Yeah.
Because he's the one that he says, like, don't leave me, mommy. Like, that's also kind of the pre-jokerized twist.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just him, like, losing it.
The storytelling of them tearing up the letter and it kind of tearing him at the same time.
Mm.
It's one of those things, like, where you explain it, you're like, oh, well, that's an obvious metaphor. But it's done so well on the page.
Yeah.
I think because it's so direct.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, and any and first stick to their face. That is such a gross, like...
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
you know, this is like a whole genre of book. Like the young boy sexual politics thing. There's a Dinpa book that I like, that I enjoy reading. We've got to find a better way to phrase this for uncomfortable works. But it's called Pleasure and Corruption by Yo Somega. And it's very similar to this, except that it stars two high schoolers. And I think the boy is stressed out from like entrance exams coming up and other nonsense. So he takes to taking upskirt photos in public transit as stress relief and gets caught by a lady, a girl. And she's like, I won't tell if you let me tie you up like bondage style. And the entire thing is sort of her pushing him into BDSM situations, like in the back of the classroom, in his, you know, bedroom at his home, and being like, you know, if you tell, like, you know, I'll show your photos, blah, 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 blah. But it hits a similar note as this. I think Pleasure and Corruption is much more lurid, would be the word, I think. Like, much more titillating than this, while this is very unsettling.
Yeah.
But both are very creepy and kind of, like, exploring things that we usually don't think about.
So do you think there's something very unique and different about Shuzo Ishimi's work that makes him, you know, kind of stand out as a comics creator? Or is this something that other creators do similarly?
I think he's a great writer. Mm-hmm. Like, the difference between this and Pleasure and Corruption would be, like, the subtlety. You know, and for a book where, like, a mom kisses a kid and pushes another kid off a cliff, like, there's actually, like, a great deal of subtlety in here. And it makes all the difference between it being, like, a book you read because, like, there might be a hint of nudity versus a book you read because you know it's going to leave, like, a little, like, kernel of coal in your heart when you're done.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Chip, was there anything you took away from this book and thought, wow, I could do this in my work, or, oh, no way I would ever do this?
I mean, there's nothing here I could do. Like, I mean, I guess if I totally changed the way I work, like, because really the standout thing for me is the pacing of it. And just, like, again, spending 12 pages on, like, a look or, like, a hand touch, which, yeah, you know, I've started drawing a new project and, like, I keep thinking, like, oh, I'm going to do something different, but I'm just doing the same kind of thing. Just because it's what I know how to do, and the idea of, like, telling a story super, super slowly, I don't have the ability to do it. It's too late for me, is what I'm saying.
I see.
Another season of manga explaining, and we'll have you back on track.
Yeah,
we'll have you decompressed for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. It's fascinating, and I'm curious to see where it goes, but it's not something I could ever replicate. Also, it's not a subject matter that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I read a lot of horribly violent stuff, but mostly not intimately or emotionally violent like this.
Yeah.
You know? Because this is like a very... Is grounded the right word? Like, you could see something like this happening in real life very easily.
Yeah.
Like, there's no fantastical elements. There's no... Nothing is too out there. And that makes it a different kind of comic for me.
Yeah.
It's like, if I'm reading something, I'm like, oh, I want to read something where, like, a bunch of people fight a monster and get, like, cut into pieces for whatever reason. That's easy to find. But it's not this, like, by any means.
It's funny, the things in society that we kind of, we feel like it's, like, kind of fun subject matter.
Yeah.
Even though it's not supposed to be fun. Like I was at a cottage this weekend and a buddy of mine was talking about the idea of like writing like a dinner party murder mystery thing. And we were just like, there's no such thing as a dinner party violent assault mystery. You know? Yeah, like
true.
Like for some reason murder just is like fun for people. Mm-hmm. Like I've known people to be murdered. It's horrible. But yet still it's like this thing in society that we're just like, oh, that's fun. So like in comics, like extreme violence is just considered like, oh no, it's fun. It's just like, you know, it's not something that would happen in real life, but something like this could happen, even though it is kind of extreme and has happened. Yeah. And that makes it a ton more unsettling than the kind of like kickboxing stuff that we're usually into.
Yeah.
I promise we'll get back to kickboxing.
This weekend, I picked up a comic that I remembered not liking, but I couldn't remember why I disliked it. So I wanted to reread it and refresh myself. And I do this to myself all the time.
Why?
And I got to the end because I was like, this sounds like something I should like. Maybe I just wasn't I was depressed or something last time I read it. And then I got to the end and I was like, oh, this is why I didn't like it. And also somebody gets poked in the eye on the last page, like on panel. And I was like, right. But that's another thing where at one point, like on-screen eye pokes were forbidden in comics. It was like too much, up to the point where like there's one involved in the creation of Image comics. Like they wanted to stab Juggernaut in the eye in a Spider-Man comic. Marvel was like, you can't do that. And Todd McFarlane and Rob Liefeld were like, okay, well, we're going to go do it somewhere else.
I didn't know that was the reason why they left.
It wasn't the only reason, but it was one of the ones they talked about, like not having control over their characters and that kind of thing.
That's why Image starts with the letter I.
Exactly. But over time, like the window has shifted to where now on-screen eye pokes are legal, you know.
They're legal.
Yeah, legal holds.
I want to kind of wrap this up a little bit by maybe starting with Chris and asking, like, you kind of came into this kind of not too hot about reading it, but I wanted to get your final thoughts on what you thought of this book.
It was exactly the kind of story I thought it was going to be, but it was better than I thought it was going to be. And I think that that's kind of awesome. I like being surprised by works like this. I'm really torn about whether or not I want to keep reading because I hope it gets better for the lead character. I know through being spoiled that there are, well, these are solicitation text. He begins to fight back and try to extricate himself from his mother at some point in the future. And I think that that is what would give me hope to keep reading. Cause if it was just going to be about this, like continuing, there's a reason that Girl on the Shore was only two volumes and then it ended. It's because if you're not prepared to like offer a solution because life doesn't always have solutions, then like keeping it going for longer than a volume, like going all done in one, is just sadism. Like it's just about wallowing in this like very specific, very shitty kind of misery. And I don't think that that's what the intent is of this author from reading this book and from knowing where it goes in future volumes. So I think I would probably actually read onwards, but like, yeah, it's not, I'd have to psych myself up for it. You know what I mean? Like I'd have to be like, okay, let's go do a couple more volumes of Girl on the Shore. Butt on the Tracks. Okay, let's do this. Okay, here we go. And then you just like, oh, and you just feel terrible and whatever. But like, I got a lot of books that I'm excited about reading that I know are going to be awesome in my library. Well, so
it's funny. You said,
in a mood.
Yeah, you said earlier about how, you know, the older you get, the less you want to like read works that, you know, that could be upsetting and painful to get through. But also, we're in a pandemic still.
Yeah.
And the world is on fire, both literally and metaphorically. Like, it's very hard to, like, there's a reason Ted Lasso is doing quite well.
Yeah.
You know?
Read some happy books, watch some happy TV. Yeah, I hear you. But I think you do have to, like, I think you have to temper that. I think watching stuff with bad feelings in it, reading stuff with bad feelings in it, is how you sort of deal with your own bad feelings. That's what fiction is, right? Like, we try to learn about ourselves through things that other people have created. So I think it was probably good to read it, but it's just, it's hard to want to, you know,
no,
unless you're in a place.
No, I get it. Like after reading this, I realized like my mom shouldn't have pushed that kid off the cliff. Shouldn't have. That's wrong.
Three this episode that we're going to have to cut out. No, it's good.
Would you recommend this to a certain type of reader? I mean, because it's obviously not for anybody, but.
for people that like other works by this author, please enjoy. There's a YouTube channel that does these, that is doing a like retrospective of the 90s 1 year at a time.
Wow.
And it's just like, and then they did the 80s before. Their next one, they're actually going to go back and do the 70s instead. And there's just this like, you're watching through and it sort of is interspersing clips and talking about them briefly. And it's like Law and Order SVU debuts, and it was like 1999. And it shows a 10-second clip that is the most upsetting thing in the whole like 25-minute video, because every episode of Law and Order SVU is about some terrible, sexually like explicit, horrible thing happening to somebody. And then people just like fucking digging into it for an hour. And it's still on TV, and people need that release. So it's like, yeah, if you are the kind of person who like can't stop watching Law and Order SVU, because even though it's like
my grandmother
and whatever, and you like that tension.
sorry, David.
Your grandma's amazing. My grandmother watched Korean dramas till the day she died.
Sorry, David. We're mailing your grandmother Blood on the Tracks, only 1 through 5, with explicit instructions to read from right to left.
Pretty good. If you're that kind of person, then like that isn't put off by that because they want that gripping story. They want to feel that tension and then like hope that there's justice at the end. Although anyone who's watched Law and Order knows that it doesn't always roll that way. I think, yeah, for sure. But you got to know what you're getting into, like to the point where I'm really thinking, like, is this a podcast? Even though I haven't sworn yet, which I'm very proud of. Do we still have to mark the podcast explicit?
I swore
just the content.
So yeah, give it time.
I didn't even catch it. I didn't even hear it. Also, big ups to your grandmother for watching Law and Order.
I don't know. So, like, we were talking about Law and Order SVU, but other like American TV shows, books, movies that you know you would recommend to like, it's similar to this book. Like, if you like this type of movie or TV show, you would like this book.
I've got two.
Oh, please
really?
Go.
Yeah. So one is David Lapham's Straight Bullets. It's not all like this, but there are several story arcs where you're like, I don't know how these kids are going to get out of this. And yeah, it has that sort of creeping dread. But even more than that would be The Good Son with Macaulay Culkin.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that was yeah. Oh, shit. Exactly that. Yeah.
Yeah. The entire time I was reading this, I was thinking, oh, this is like a reverse Good Son. But then I was like, there's not like a right way for The Good Son to go. Mm. But it was the movie where Macaulay was basically like a teen psychopath serial killer or something like that. And he meets his cousin, and the cousin is confronted with, you know, Macaulay being evil. Also, the cousin's Elijah Wood, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's just this movie of like two boys. You would think it'd be like a fun summer, you know, out of school movie. And it's Macaulay killing people and throwing bricks off bridges and doing horrible things.
Yeah.
Up until like a very amazing ending, come to think about it. And I was 10 years old when this came out, maybe like 9 or 10. So I went from Home Alone to this. And it was a lot, but I think that it's similarly effective where you're like, oh, this is a good thing turned corrupted. Like the mother-son relationship or, you know, a young boy like exploring the woods is suddenly bad and evil because of the things that are going on. So if you like either one of those two, I think this would be right up your alley.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah.
Right up your dark alley.
Right up your dark alley. Title of your porn tape. Wow.
Yeah.
Jeff, any final thoughts on this one?
It's really well done. I think Chris got it right with Law and Order SVU and David's grandmother. I think that's the audience for it. It's funny. I'm watching Sopranos right now. I missed it the first time around, and like the main character Tony Soprano, like at some point his mom basically tries to orchestrate his murder. I thought about that reading this.
Wow.
Oh yeah, man. It's just like mom's gone bad.
Mom's gone bad.
Yeah,
mom's
not wild. Bad. Bad.
Yeah, this is a really interesting, different kind of mom's gone bad, right? It's not an obvious one like you know, like Mommy Dearest, where the mom is just psychotic. Yeah. Or even like Fatal Attraction, where the woman is just, you know, insane, right?
Yeah.
This is a little more, it's a little bit more of a slow burn. At the same time, I guess what I found compelling about that is like I read enough manga where you can almost see what's going to happen next, right? Like you know the story beats, you know what's kind of coming around the corner. This one surprised me a lot. There are a lot of moments where I'm like, whoa, what just happened here?
Yeah, for sure.
I was talking out loud by when they were ripping up the letter. Like, I was done by that point.
I know. Yeah. I mean, if there was someone in the room with me, they would have been like, are you okay? Because, like, my body was just, like, kind of, like, collapsing in on itself a little bit as I was reading it. Like, no, don't open that door.
See, that's fascinating, right? Because this manga, you cannot read passively.
No.
You're going to react.
No.
And that's interesting to me.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
All right. I think that's a good discussion of Blood on the Tracks. And we are going to be right back after this hopefully lucrative commercial message.
Lucrative for who?
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back. We are here with another Manga-splaining Listen to Me segment. We just finished talking about Blood on the Tracks by Shuzo Oshimi, and it occurred to me, while we can't probably get Shuzo Oshimi to explain himself to us or talk a little bit about his manga, I thought we'd get the next best thing, and that is Ed Chavez, publisher from Denpub Publishing.
Hi, Ed. It's good to see you.
Yeah, likewise. It's been a while.
Could you just introduce yourself for the listeners?
As you guys kindly noted, I'm the publisher president of Denpub Books. We're a small independent publisher based out of Portland, Oregon. I've been around since late 2018, focusing on a mix of modern pop with a tinge of some indie manga and a little bit of, I wouldn't necessarily say like classical manga, but more critically acclaimed artists. So for example, we just released an anthology of cat comics from Moto Hagio called Little Leo. We're also going to be releasing like a mockumentary about Yoshiyuki Tomino, the original creator of Mobile Suit Gundam. So works like that, yeah, mixed in with things like Invitation from a Crab or Maiden Railways. And then things that are a little more modern and contemporary that are kind of pushing the needle in Japan. Once again, with the focus on talent of artists that are significant there. So, you know, Shuzo Oshimi is a great example of that. But, you know, we have artists like Nobuyuki Fukumoto, the creator of Kaiji, Shintaro Kago as well.
Oshimi is why I wanted to reach out. I think why Deb especially wanted to reach out. It's because Oshimi is a creator that has such a singular vision. And so Shuzo Oshimi's Flowers of Evil was their first work translated in English. And you acquired that during your time at Vertical.
Yeah.
And the big question that we both kind of had when we were talking about it is like, what did you see in this author's work that made you want to bring them to English readers? Because it doesn't look like a home run. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't look like a grand slam.
Yeah. Yeah, there's an interesting story behind that, too, because that was something that we picked up around the time that Attack on Titan was published. They ran in the same magazine.
Oh, really?
In Japan.
Wow.
You know, when I read through Gekkan Shonen Magazine and saw Flowers, Oshimi's storytelling and the way he's able to show as well as tell just hit me so hard. It just beat me up. I really wanted to look into him more at that time. And what, you know, contrasting that to Titan at the same time, I thought that the storytelling was compelling, but it didn't feel that the artists had fully grasped, you know, what manga presenting and like visually storytelling was at the time. Like he was more just putting things out, and he had a really good idea and a great like story concept, but just wasn't able to present what he wanted, you know, clearly. On the flip side, Oshimi, very early on, and particularly in Flowers of Evil, was already working with moments that you were looking and experiencing the depression, the loneliness, the frustration, the angst of the settings that he had, as well as of the youth that he was presenting in his story. So it was really visceral. And generally speaking, I tend to pick up manga that do a lot of that try to like not just give you walls and walls of text, you know, that actually allow the page as a whole to tell the story. You know, that includes the backgrounds and even the paneling. So if you ever get a chance to go through Flowers of Evil again, there's some really great spreads too. Like there's one where the two main characters have kind of come to terms with their feelings about high school and the little exurb town that they live in. They know that they don't want to be there, but they found each other, and they literally destroy like their high school classroom. Wow. There's ink and paper and desks everywhere. Upon looking at that, you just feel like all of these emotions, and it doesn't necessarily like, if you look at it by itself, like it's striking, but the lead up and how he presents like the panels and those pages and even like the close-ups in people's faces, like he is driving the reader visually to like get really excited and to, you know, associate with the passion that Oshimi's trying to render on those pages. Yeah, so it was a no-brainer. Like I showed like the other editors at Vertical at the time, like the first two volumes of Flowers. I think that's all that was available, and they were like, "No, this is intense. This is some of the closest visual manga-king, comic-king we've seen since Tezuka."
That's high praise, dude.
For people who were working on that for a long time, up to like 2000, and I think that was like around 2011.
Yeah.
Wow.
We really felt that way.
Because Vertical published a lot of Tezukas, and so that's where that praise comes from, because they knew that material intimately. Yeah.
It's something that kind of gets lost for some readers, but in our case, that's literally what we want in comics. We want to become immersed in those feelings. And Oshimi, I don't know, this might sound like hyperbole, but I feel that he's possibly one of like the top 10 artists in the last decade or so to be able to like accomplish that on a regular basis. And what's cool too is that, like, as he ends up cranking out new series, I mean, I think he's done like four or five since Flowers of Evil. He's come to really understand that, yeah, he doesn't necessarily need to rely on dialogue as much anymore. You go through Happiness. I'm sure parts of Blood in the Tracks are like this as well, but I think that's a little wordier. But there are moments where you just see in Blood like a mother's face, and you're like, you just stop, right? It's just like you understand like her frustration and her anger. And then Oshimi will turn the perspective around, and you'll see the child's face and how they're witnessing this. And very, very few manga take the time to present those moments like that. Like, instead, they'll write it out, and they'll, you know, have exposition, let you know what's going on. But Oshimi doesn't do that. Actually, Oshimi rarely relies on exposition, really. So
yeah, that makes perfect sense, actually, when you say it that way, because I do see a lot of that personally. Deb, you're a little more familiar with Oshimi's works. I actually want to ask both of you this. When you saw Flowers of Evil, when you licensed Flowers of Evil, did you ever think that, like, nearly all of his work would be in English someday. Like, it seemed like such an offbeat choice. Now, like, Denpa's got Inside Mari, you're doing Devil Ecstasy.
Yeah.
I'm just licensing a bunch of them. Like, did you guys ever think when you picked up Flowers Evil, you know, that this is going to be someone who's going to have all of their work translated in English, kind of like Junji Ito almost?
Yes, actually. Ooh. I wouldn't say all of it. You know, I'll be frank. Devil's Ecstasy is a little rough.
That's not in English yet, right?
Not yet. No, Kodansha is going to be releasing that, I think, early next year. But like that was a series that was canceled in Japan, and he didn't come back and finish that until he was successful. Like I think he finished that like after Flowers of Evil was either about to end or had just completed. That's one of those situations where Kodansha was like, "Oh, hey, you know, let's have you wrap this up for some closure. You're doing well." But very early on, I already knew I wanted to do Inside Mari, and we were going back and forth about Mari internally. When I was at Vertical, we wanted to do another title that is yet to be announced by anybody, but I have a feeling that might get announced at some point. And then, upon me moving over to launch Denpa, was that our first acquisition? I want to say it was either number one or number two.
Something you went after.
No, it was actually our first book that we or first series that we released was Inside Mari, Volume 1. I knew right from the start that I wanted to do Oshimi, and I wanted to be able to get as much of that as possible. So Blood on the Tracks was something that we also tried to get, but it was too late. Happiness was already being published by Kodansha USA at the time. It was basically, try to pick up whatever else we could from the publishers that we have greater access to. And then
Futabasha and stuff like that, right?
Futabasha, Shodansha, Oda,
You also published some of the shorter stories, like Waltz.
Yeah, Waltz and Miss Kusada.
Shino Can't See Her Name.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting because like Chris was saying, that this is a creator you've placed a lot of bets on.
Yeah, that kind of goes back to the ethos of Denpa in a way. Like, we're... I get this question a lot from publishers in Japan, like, what genres are you guys interested in? And I basically, that's not really our thing. I don't expect to be doing too many isekai. But our primary focus is really on authors or artists. Working with an Oshimi, we want to try to get out as much Oshimi as possible. We want him to be within our umbrella. We want to hold him as tight as we can.
I
want to ask you too.
Amazing. Yeah.
Have you talked with him?
Unfortunately, I haven't. I have talked to his editors in the past. And what was cool with those experiences, the two that I've met are basically, they've been about like my age. I remember when actually I picked up or was negotiating Flowers of Evil for Vertical, Kodansha introduced me to the editor of that when I was over there. We immediately hit on a lot of the same points.
Oh, great.
And how we were reading that manga, which was really interesting. I think that kind of goes back to one of the themes that I feel is very common in Oshimi's work, and that's, he's trying to express a lot of the frustration that youth have, and he takes that topic and goes in different directions with it, whether it's family or just kind of feeling lost in society or not having, too many opportunities for the future or being a part of a young married couple. Like, a lot of these topics are things that I feel, teens to like people in their 30s can really relate to. And we immediately clicked with Oshimi, which is really fun. I think that also kind of accelerated the interest within Kodansha themselves about like, oh, hey, maybe we should start pushing a little bit more of that too.
All you need is someone to get excited about it on this side of the Pacific, and things can start to move a little bit more quickly. That's cool. Yeah. Well, that answers all my questions, Deb. Did you have anything else you wanted to ask Ed?
No, I think that's perfect. I mean, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about Shizuo Oshimi with us. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Not much, but I think, and I hope you don't mind me like taking this time to kind of pimp one of our books, but I think for Oshimi fans, you know, his manga is great, and you know they're fun, and he covers a pretty good range of genres. He has a little bit of horror, a little bit of sci-fi, as well as his dramas. But I think something that an Oshimi fan needs to pick up is Femme Fatale, which is the art book that we released earlier this year. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying before. You know, Oshimi does a great job just framing moods, framing his feelings. And what was really funny is sharing that with like my staff here. They've been up and down working with Oshimi. They've actually, both of my production managers here have worked on Oshimi for titles for 10 years now. So I can tell that they may be a little tired of his stuff. But when they were looking at Femme Fatale and just looking at his color work in particular, they come to appreciate the fact that, yeah, I mean, not only is he a good artist, but they were like, yeah, there's no text on the majority of these pages. And they could immediately get what Oshimi was trying to put out. And I think that's something that's rare. And, you know, combine that with obviously full color in a nice little package, I think fans would really, really get to know a little bit more about Oshimi in a different type of context. And yeah, I think that would be a very good experience for a lot of people.
Well, we'll pop a link to that in the show notes so people can check it out.
Well, I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much, Ed. This was really interesting, and thank you for taking the time, and thank you also for publishing so much of Chuzo Oshimi's work in English. Mm. It's very much appreciated.
Well, it's an honor. It's a pleasure.
All right. Back to the rest of the show, I guess. Thanks a lot, Ed. We are back. We will now open up our little Q&A bag. We got one from a reader, Stephen Recker, who commented on our blog, and he had a pretty, well, kind of straightforward question, but I wonder if it has a straightforward answer. He asks, are there any major manga published in color? I understand the industry is rooted in black and white magazine serialization and that a color section is occasionally used to introduce a new serial, but are there any manga published in color either in first run or in reprinted trades? Is it simply a budgetary decision, or is it more of a case of tradition? Is there any actual opposition to the idea of color manga? Anyway, you want to dig into this one, Chris? David?
Yeah, actually, I just was thinking about it while you were reading the question, and it's interesting that maybe the most popular and best-selling color manga in English was commissioned by a French publisher, and it's Rohan at the Louvre. From JoJo's Bizarre Adventures. It's a spin-off one volume from this like Louvre special edition of like comic stuff. And he did this like full color manga that's like a side story from, I think, JoJo's Part 5. There's a bunch of manga that have worked. Part 4. Thank you, JoJo's Bizarre Adventure editor David Brothers. There's a bunch of manga in that line that are like, are they manga because they were commissioned in France first? Did they get simul-published? Like, people get real hung up on what is or isn't manga. I don't really care anymore. But yeah, straight up, I think that the French full color volumes are maybe some of the most interesting color manga. But short answer, like, nah. Traditional manga publishers in Japan, like the economy, the economics of scale of publishing manga, of serializing it, all that kind of stuff in a traditional manga don't make sense. So there's very, very, very few color projects out there. And I'm sure there's a list. I'm sure there's a Wikipedia subpage somewhere that lists all manga in color. But I think the color manga that I see these days when I'm going through Japanese bookstores and whatnot is absolutely webcomics, is people serializing comics digitally online, sometimes just on Twitter, like posting pages on Twitter, you know, through app services and things like that. My favorite that, and again, these will all never get translated because they, first off, it's color. So North American publishers of manga don't have that economy to publish color manga, but Hige-san and Marshmallow. And it's about a chubby dude with facial hair who likes marshmallows, and he works in an office, and there's an OL, like an office lady there, who's in love with him, but he's only in love with marshmallows. And it is the cutest manga. It was actually turned into an anime, like little 10-minute episodes or 5-minute episodes that would run between other things. And you can watch it on Crunchyroll, even though the manga will never be translated. And it's just like the most basic dumb thing, but it's so cute and I love it. He gets on a marshmallow or mustache, Mr. Mustache and Marshmallow, whatever they translated the title to. But there's a lot of books like that. Things that were showed up on Pixiv as original comic serializations, things that showed up on Twitter, things that showed up on other websites. So yeah, if you're looking for traditional manga, there's just not a lot of color. But if you're looking for to expand your horizons about a little bit, I think that there's stuff out there for sure. But Deb, I mean, there's also like webtoons and things like that. You've done a lot of research on like the online manga sphere, not always public research on the online manga sphere, but like, is color more of a go-to like in that space, or like, is there still just a lot of black and white work there? Or?
There's still a lot of black and white stuff. I mean, you know, like cell phone manga and stuff like that. There's still a lot of black and white stuff because frankly, it's faster to draw, right? And it's quick and disposable. And it also lends itself well to being printed later. But there are instances where there are manga that are published in black and white in a magazine, but then colored later, like Cheese Sweet Home.
I was going to mention that as a counterpoint to Chris's point about Rohan being the bigger seller, I think.
Oh, Cheese is a bigger seller for sure.
Yeah.
I think it's flipped and it's watercolor colored in.
Yeah. It's interesting because it's technically colorized rather than colored. Like when it was serialized, it was black and white. Mm-hmm. But in the paperbacks, it's color, which is something that I feel like also is rare.
But then there's also the Dragon Ball color editions, right?
Yeah, there are also digital JoJo's color editions.
I think there's a color Spy Family version too.
Yeah, really? They're usually special editions, I think. So basically, if it's a hit and it makes enough money to support a color edition, it might get a color edition.
But it's interesting because it's not as much of a given. Like it feels like, Chip, maybe you can answer this, but for American readers, is color a must-have for American superhero comics?
Yes. I mean, Walking Dead is the exception that proves the rule, I guess. Mm-hmm. But also, I think the costs are different here. Oh. Like, I remember in the past talking to printers about doing black and white comics, and they were like, well, you might as well just do it in color. Like, the cost difference is so negligible because the printers are set up for that. Oh. Mm-hmm. Like, it's basically just running it through the same printer, and I guess it's using less ink. But I would imagine because of how popular manga is in Japan, and because of the Shonen Jump phone books, that there are printers that probably just do black and white. So to do a color, you'd have to go to another printer and it would cost you probably a lot more. So it's the same thing with like newsprint. Like if I wanted to do a black and white comic on newsprint, it would probably cost me more than doing a color one on just like the standard comic paper now. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so I think the economy of it makes a difference. And also just the fact that like, because companies like Marvel and DC have just done color for so many years, that's just what people expect. So doing a black and white comic would be like, what? Black and white? Yeah. Indie? What is this, indie? And they would just ignore it.
Really?
That's literally happening to DC Comics right now. Their Future State Gotham book, which is written and drawn by like three dudes that I know, which is kind of weird, but kind of cool at the same time.
Okay.
So it's like set in the near future, Gotham City, Batman is dead. It's sort of like an event book that's an ongoing series, I think. And it's kind of interesting. It's cool. And it's all in black and white. And Giannis Milano Giannis, who did like Old City Blues, and he did, I think, New Ultimates, one of the Ultimate books. Yeah. Great artist. And it looks amazing. But I think because DC readers are so used to color, they're like, wait, why did they leave off a layer? Like, why does it look like this?
Like, it feels like a mistake.
Yeah. And meanwhile, I'm over here, like, I want 100 superhero comics like this. Like, it looks, it feels so weird and strange and compared to what I'm used to reading, that it feels fresh, you know?
Yeah.
And the first issue had an Otomo backup in it, so I feel like there's nothing to complain about. But I'm horrifically biased.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, like, I mean, black and white is generally just looked at as such a different thing that they actually, like, do them as prestige books. Like,
you know,
I did a Batman black and white with Nick Bradshaw because they brought that back, and that's just like, oh, they even label it black and white. Like, look at us. Look at what we're doing. Isn't it classy for a change? But yeah, it's just not as much a thing here.
I love the trend of black and white and a third color that's been going on for like the past couple of years.
I know they do this now. It's like Electro, black, white, and red or blood or whatever. I'm just like,
Interesting.
Yeah, like God bless them. They're my employer, but this is a train that's going to run out of steam real soon.
It's cheating a little bit, But it's cool.
Yeah.
I was going to say there's probably another factor as far as like the manga in black and white is that you'll notice that if you take your average manga tankobon that's printed in black and white with some color, with a handful of color pages, and you hold a color book the similar size in your hand, one will be remarkably much more heavy.
Yeah.
Because coated paper is heavier, and therefore it costs you more to ship a case of those books.
A really good joke about that in Skeleton Bookstore Sell or Bookstore Worker Honda-san.
Yes, where it's yes. Like,
they've got to work in the American comics in Japanese section for the day. And they're every time they everything, they're like, oh my God, it's so heavy. I can't even do this. It's really, really good. We'll pop that in the show notes. It's like such a funny panel. But yeah, absolutely. Like everything in Japan is 99% of manga in Japan is printed in Japan. And that is not the case in North America. Like there are North American printers, but especially color books are printed overseas, India, Korea, Taiwan, China, Hong Kong, like they're like color books are more and more, not single issue comics, which just because of the turnaround on them tend to be printed domestically. We just don't have a domestic printing industry. And so when we actually need it, like right now, when everyone's buying books like crazy, it doesn't exist anymore. And so that's why every manga that you love is out of print right now and is maybe coming by the end of next year. So it's a real, you're getting into the parts of comics, which are like, that we don't really talk about, which is the number crunching behind the scenes, like, oh, how is this going to work? Print scheduling, print brokering stuff, right?
And
it's hard to ramp
all that business stuff up. Like, you think there's a chip shortage right now and you can't get a graphics card, like, try and get a copy of Jujutsu Kaisen Volume 1. Like, that's just as rare as a 3080. Sorry, that's a very targeted
I honestly thought you meant Zdarsky for a second.
I like, know. Where's he
going
here
with this?
No. I thought you meant the Frito-Lay strike.
No, I don't.
That was a problem too.
Yeah,
yeah. The Chip's comment about like shipping jump and like there being facilities in place to make this happen and make it cheap made me realize that there's probably printers that only do jump because if they have a circulation of lowballing it at a million a week. That's an astronomical amount of paper.
Yeah.
And at, 450 to 500 pages a week, it's even worse.
I think I read that there's multiple printers that are doing, it's not centralized printing. Like if you're in Osaka and you get a copy of Jump, it was maybe printed closer to you. But if you're up in the north in like Aomori or something, you're just one of those printers. So not only is your book that popular, but it's the same book as being simultaneously printed all over the all over the country. Just to try and get as many copies as you can into the hands of people that want them every week. Like, that's crazy. That's awesome. Like, awesome. I've only heard of that happening in North America, like, once or twice where, like, initial orders were printed at a domestic printer because a book was so late, and then the bulk of the order was printed overseas so that by the time the reorders came up, there was already another edition ready to go.
Yeah.
Like, but shipping takes, like, 3 to 4 months. But that's like Jump, that's every week where it's being printed. I think 4 to 6 printers are printing Jump simultaneously. So,
and that's another one of those, this inside baseball thing you mentioned is another reason why it's hard to compare manga to superhero comics so directly, or shonen manga to superhero comics so directly. Because that's always the conversation online is like, DC should just make Shonen Jump. But like, there's not 4 printers in 4 locations across North America that could ship something like Shonen Jump for DC.
You'd be lucky
the paper
to get it
quality. Yeah. The production requirements, it's just a different, it's like comparing one kind of apple to another species of apple, unless apple is a species instead of a genus.
I think it's apples and pears.
Yeah, there we go.
They're similar,
but
very
different. But yeah, like there's, because of how comics and manga evolved in Japan, like the industry, the infrastructure is fascinating. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to get lost in the weeds.
I've always wanted to make like an amazing, like an visual infographic that shows the difference in scale between manga and American comics. And somehow I can never get the numbers to be able to pull that off. Mm-hmm. But I promise it's astronomical.
Yeah.
The difference is astronomical.
It would just make me sad. Please don't do it.
If you've had work translated into Japanese, Chip, you're grandfathered in. So
it's all good. All right. Nice.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for another really great discussion. I hope that we've at least turned on some special people to this very special book. And I hope that this answered your question, Stephen. If anyone else has questions for Manga Spinning, please reach out to us because our mailbag could always use some great questions. That's it for now, and we'll be back next week. Thanks a lot. This has been Mangasplaining Season 2, Episode 6. Thank you for listening. For our next episode, we'll be discussing the manga Tokyo Tarareba Girls by Akiko Higashimura. Want to pick up a copy? Consider supporting your local comic book and manga specialty shop. Find one near you at comicshoplocator.com or check out your local library for print and digital lending options. You can also follow along with our complete reading list at mangasplaining.com. Thanks to DADS for their musical accompaniment for this episode.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.